Hi, I'm Anthea Butler. I'm Associate Professor of Religion at the University of Pennsylvania.
And
And
I'm Julian Sanchez, a research fellow at the Cato Institute.
hi, Julian. How are you today?
Great.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about in the news, so I thought maybe we could get started with the subject that has consumed Twitter, Facebook, all media all the time for the last 3 weeks, and that's Trayvon Martin. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this. I've been doing a lot of talking to people and tweeting about it, and it seems like A, it's the case that won't go away, and B, we've looked at it so many different ways, but I think there's some other things that we can start to think about in terms of this case.
Yeah, I mean in a way the weirdest thing to me is seeing a specific event that I mean an obviously sort of horrific one turn into a partisan issue or turn into a sort of subject for partisan agreement where people have sort of politically predictable differing positions on this. It's also just been depressing to watch some of the media reaction. I mean. Attempts to portray Trayvon somehow as a thug or culpable. Now I guess the flip side is right is that the concern with cases like this is that in some sense the reason cases like this become national stories is that they in a kind of Mike Daisy-esque sense are allegories or capture something that people think is a broader truth that goes beyond this one sort of awful incident. And so, I think in this case, obviously, the attention comes to it not just because, of course, people want to see justice done for one person, but because, there's a sense that it's not a one-off, that the deeper truth in some sense that is captured here is that people are far too ready to assume that a young black man wearing a hoodie or dressed a certain way is up to something bad and more to the point and I think the real reason it's a national story is that people feel that police have the same reaction that in this case the what people say of course is that they think certainly if the races had been reversed if the if Trayvon had been the one who had been armed that night, you would not, people suspect, see police taking his claims of self-defense so readily. And I think there's plenty of evidence that's come out over time that suggests that whatever happened, the there's a lot of information the police didn't have when they decided that it
Absolutely.
was all right to take a pass on this. But the flip side of this is that you watch as some of these debates play out, and you almost feel like people get locked into the value of the story as an allegory, and so then they become committed to the idea that the facts of this case sort of have to be, in a sense, a perfect allegory. That if we know, five details that suggest that, this fits a certain archetype of a story. That then they can be absolutely certain that everything else about what happened has to fit that, and that's a little unsettling. I mean, the evidence that we have so far does suggest certainly that George Zimmerman in this case was sort of looking for a fight or looking for some kind of confrontation. That he we don't, as far as we can tell, didn't seem to have very good reason for. Thinking that a kid walking around in the rain in a hoodie was up to anything unlawful. On the other hand, everything that happened after that is obviously radically uncertain. And so it's just weird to watch kind of people online who have never set foot anywhere within 1,000 miles of Sanford, Florida, kind of not just talking about how it might have happened, but being
But being very sure
kind of
about how it happened, right?
right.
Because they think
Right.
they know. So let me talk about this sort of three ways, because we're going to come at this from a different way. One, I want to talk about it as a historian. As a historian of African American religion and African American history, I go, this is a story that we've heard a lot, right? And it's a story that, kid, black guy, black person, anybody gets involved with somebody, somebody shoots, the facts are murky. they're never prosecuted, okay? Right. And there are lots of stories like this. So I think in one sense that the narrative of the past influences the narrative of the present, okay?
Right.
So there's obviously, on both sides, people thinking, here's what's happened. We can tell what's happened with Zimmerman. Look, he didn't have anything on him. We've seen the tapes. We've seen all this stuff. Therefore, mm-hmm. we go to this conclusion that he was wrong and he committed a crime, right? Now, I think on my part at least, I see there's lots of problems, but one big issue that I think no one wants to sort of address, and this is politically nor socially, are the structural issues that have a George Zimmerman out there believing that he can police. And I think there was a great piece in the New York Times about this where it talked about a sort of a historical lens on all of this. And George Zimmerman absolutely thought, in a sense, that he could police the neighborhood, that being neighborhood mm-hmm. watch was not just watching, it was policing. And mm-hmm. this is sort of the issue for me politically, is that on one hand, you have people who want to say this is an individualistic thing. This is not about race. It's not about race. But why would you have a George Zimmerman out there thinking that he could sort of profile Trayvon in a certain kind of way if we didn't have this history and this structural issue about how, you know, people, there's racial profiling, all of these things. So that's the first piece. The second piece that I think was just sort of the reprehensible piece for me was the moment when the president said, you know, Trayvon could have been my son. It looks like it could have been my
right.
son, right? And then this became heavily politicized on, you know, on the right. Everybody said, oh, this is about individual stuff. This is not about everything else.
Right.
I love how we all go to the individual when it's something that's about race because we have to say, we're transcending this, blah, blah. You know, like,
right.
it's very clear we have it. So, I mean, I find the problem for me is that in the endless prosecution and of the case, one, and the endless persecution of Trayvon, and in a way, Zimmerman, we can't get to the truth. And the structural issues in Florida, where this person has not been arrested, the grand jury is just now getting ready to sit, I think, April 10th, something mm-hmm. like that. And then you have a Department of Justice investigation. It's going to be a while before something happens with George Zimmerman. And in the meantime, we're all at, you know, DEFCON 5 about how we feel either side of the case, and that's not very helpful for anyone.
Mm-hmm. I think my friend Jamel Bowie posted on his blog over the American Prospect, you know, one of these surveys that comes out every now and again with this sort of very predictable result that, if you sort of survey blacks and whites or other groups, you get this sort of radically different reporting of their attitude of how sort of serious a problem things like race bias continue to be, how serious an obstacle that continues to be, and so there's this huge divide in how it's perceived, and so I think what that cashes out in cases like this is what you see is like is kind of a really high evidentiary burden. For making anything about race, or for assuming or inferring that there's a racial component to a case of apparent profiling, in a case where the police were very quick to take one party's word for how things played out, it almost seems. I mean, I almost wonder if it isn't that we've sort of done such a good job of identifying the idea of racism with this sort of its ugliest its sort of most overt kind of crass manifestations. So part of this is sort of making racism this sort of radioactive word in a way that sexism, for example, isn't. I think people are much more kind of willing to say, well, I guess that's a little sexist, but in a way that nobody says, well, that's a little racist, but.
Yeah, no. It's always the big thing that makes it really big and racist, right?
Right.
And it's not the everyday slights. It's the
right.
big, it's the big event like a Trayvon, right?
But I think it's also that people have a conception that, oh, a racist is, a guy wearing a hood and screaming racial epithets and kind of overtly proclaiming white supremacy or something. And so if it's not this kind of very self-conscious sort of caricature of what racism looks like, then the kind of default is, well, then it's not. And so the bar is very high. People say, okay, this isn't, unless basically he was sort of screaming racial slurs, and you're sure that that's what he was saying, the default is to assume race has nothing to do with it unless,
uncontrovertible
evidence otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. But I wonder if, and now this is where I'm going to sort of push back on your explanation a little bit, I wonder if this is only because this is on the side of white people thinking this. Because I think for African Americans, you feel these racial slights all the time, whether it's somebody who follows you in the store, or you get on, you hail a cab and the cab passes you by, you don't get served at the same time somebody else does. You know what those slights are, okay?
Right.
And you're used to feeling them all the time. Whereas if you are in the privileged position, i.e. being white, you only think that there's racism if it's a major event. Like a Trayvon. And so it has to be something that fires up everything, like you say, sheets, whatever the case may be, somebody saying the N-word out loud, and then it becomes racial. Otherwise, it's not racial. But then again, I think about, a lot of the comments about this whole case, and I still see that there's people, there's even African Americans. I'm thinking about C.L. Jackson, who's he called Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton, what did he call them, race traders or something? Because not race traders, but they were basically race hustlers. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Because they were, trading in on this case. And I wanted to say to him, how do you think you get to say what you do unless somebody was out there race hustling for you in the civil rights movement? You cannot make these sort of broad, generous statements. And I think we're so apt to think, we have a black president. Clearly we're post-racial. And I'm like, no, we're not post-racial. We're in the middle of some kind of really seething cauldron about race. And there was something else I wanted to sort of bring up. It's probably a little bit, you were probably a lot younger than I remember this because I was living in Los Angeles. But the Los Angeles riots were 20 years ago this month. And that was obviously the Rodney King beating. We saw that, the video. Everybody said, this was definitely a case of the police going above and beyond by beating down Rodney King. And that, they were acquitted, and immediately LA went up in flames. And so this was a case in which, there's a trial. The trial's held out in this, rural community of Simi Valley. And, when they come through with the thing, literally 2 hours later, I remember I was at my job that day, and I said to everybody, it's time to go home now. And they're like, what's wrong with you? And I said, I'm going home early because something's getting ready to happen. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I was right. And so what worries me about this whole case, and there are people have said, don't say this out loud, because there's no place for the animus to go. And there's nothing that's happening. And so we're just seething right now. Everybody's just mad. And if that anger doesn't have some place to go, if there's no justice done, then what ends up happening? What ends up happening to all these people? That's what I don't understand. And where does all this go?
So the thought has crossed my mind that we are at a point where, imagine they indict, and then imagine, it's not crazy to say, a jury looks at this, says, okay, you've got some witnesses that seem to say, this story's backed up enough, and maybe we're not sure it happened the way he said, but... maybe that's reasonable doubt. You don't want to say, you don't want to say that justice has to mean the jury must come to a particular verdict, but then you wonder, if we are all convinced that this was, frankly it looks like, is there any way to kind of allow that outcome without sort of some sort of explosive, reaction. It seems like the stakes get raised when a case like this is made the sort of synecdoche for the whole problem. I remember thinking that sort of it's interesting. It becomes a national story in a case like this. You wonder how much. The problem is that there are, sort of smaller or less, sort of less egregious fact patterns, but that if you're not in that community, the stories about the minor kind of versions don't make national news, which I think creates that asymmetry in perception.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And Stanford seems like it's this place that has had a lot of problems to begin with. I just, every time I hear something about Florida, I just cringe because I think it's always the worst case scenario in Florida. What is it with the state that it's always the worst case scenario, whether it's a hanging chad or anything else? It just seems to take on mythic proportions when it happens in Florida. But the town already had a problem. I mean, in every way, this was sort of like waiting to happen because you had a police force that was already, you know, sort of suspect with other cases in town. You had the Orlando Sentinel that had to close up its office there because of the, you know, newspaper money situation. So they weren't covering things that were happening in Sanford the same kinds of ways that they might have before had they had the office there. So I kind of just wonder, you know, and looking at this whole thing, if this wasn't just an accident waiting to happen. And then you have the added layer of the Stand Your Ground law. And that's the big piece because it's not even just the racial piece now. It's the NRA piece. It's a lobbying piece because these laws from ALEC and, you know, these lobbyists have really changed the face of what's happening in this country. I don't really think that the average American understands how many people are packing weapons that are walking alongside them every day. I'm from Texas. I know this, okay? My dad tells me, you know, there's a waiting list to get on the firing range on some days. You can't get out there. And so when you've got this kind of event, you've got, you know, a profiling event alongside an event where you have, you know, someone with a weapon and someone who's not armed, and it ends up badly for the person who's not armed, then I begin to wonder how much are we willing to start to look at what these gun laws are all about. Because I think that people, you know, the lobbyists don't want us to, but I think it comes a time in this country where we're going to have to figure out, can we trust somebody else without having to feel like we need to be armed to just go out to go get groceries?
Well, so I'll say two things. I mean, I actually am not sure how central the Stand Your Ground stuff is. I mean, so there's a couple aspects of this. One, I recall reading that you know, so part of the issue is that it actually raises the bar to even arresting or indicting in a case where there's a self-defense claim made, and that seems strange. But the focus has been on the you know, the no duty to retreat thing. In this particular case, it seems like there's like two options, basically, right? Either it happened roughly as Zimmerman said, in which case, even if he was following or you know, did, you know, approached him in some way to say, well, what are you doing around here? But he was actually not the first one to turn it violent. He was actually attacked and was on the ground. If that were the case, then it's not clear that he was in any position to retreat at the time it actually turned into a fight. So not having a duty to retreat wouldn't make a difference. The alternative is that he did actually start it, that not just by, you know, asking questions, but actually, you know, tried to detain Trayvon or otherwise made it physical, in which case he started it, in which case he also wasn't standing his ground because he was the initiator. So either way, that doesn't seem like it should be the relevant feature. The other thing I'll say is just that it seems like, you know, attitudes about this are different. I mean, there's like a kind of urban and, you know, rural or exurban divide, just because I think it's, you know, if I get, well, I mean, this has happened, right? If I get, you know, jumped on the street a couple blocks from my house, you know, there's other people around. Someone did come out, you know, scare them away, and then the cops will be there in 3 minutes. And in regions where that's not the case, where, you know, if you're even in your home or the victim of a crime or you know, an attempted assault, there isn't anyone else to see, you know, probably it's 15 minutes before anyone will get there if something happens. So, you know, I think urban sort of folks with urban assumptions about whether or not, you know, some kind of self-help defense is necessary, or, you know, maybe just give shorter shrift to the sort of inability of police in more dispersed areas to do the kind of immediate sort of protection job that people expect.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I live in Philadelphia, and I know some places you get, you know, if you call, you're going to get somebody immediately. If you call at other places, you're not going to get somebody to come immediately. But I do think that this law has a lot to do with what's happening, in the sense that it makes it a lot easier for you to go out and decide that I could do something. Now, you know, I want to go back to Zimmerman for a second. You know, when the dispatcher says, don't get out, I'm going to send the police right over there, and he does it anyway. Is that the moment where he starts to take the law into his own hands, even before the altercation begins? Because he, you know, it's not like the dispatcher could give him an order, but the dispatcher gave a directive to say, you know, you need to be safe, just wait in your car, we're sending a police person over. Mm-hmm. And if he had done that, if he had just not, you know, not gotten out of the car, the story might be very different. But I suspect that the George Zimmermans of this world, and I don't want to just blame it on George Zimmerman, the George Zimmermans of this world have feel that being armed makes them a arm of the legal system. Okay, mm-hmm. And that perception for people, because I am armed, therefore I can be the law in my own space, becomes mm-hmm. a real problem. And I think that perception of having weaponry be that you can also be in a policing mode is mm-hmm. it's not just for protection anymore. I mean, clearly he had another idea about what it meant to carry a weapon in that yeah. particular gated neighborhood. And then I'll say this is the other thing. I've been looking about how to think about what's happened with, sort of the how we talk about these gated communities and everything, and how we're sort of creating these places where people can block themselves off from everyone, right? Mm-hmm. And that false sense of security when you see somebody who doesn't seem like they belong becomes mm-hmm. like, this is like the virus we have to get out, right? Because we want to shield ourselves from everybody else. And what is that creating for people when you don't know how to just recognize the simple fact of somebody's walking down the street between somebody looking suspicious? I mean, that everybody becomes suspicious, right? And I wonder what that does for our, you know, future generations and things like that, and how we trust each other. I mean, all the mm-hmm. politicians want to go back and say, oh, it's small-town America, it's this and that. I'm like, there's no such thing as small-town America anymore, because if you walk down the street, small-town America, and you don't look like you belong, you know, everybody's going to think about how they're going to come and get you. So, it pains me in a way, because if a kid can't go to 7-Eleven and come back and ends up, you know, dead on a slab for 3 days, and the parents don't know where he is, and then they finally get told this story, and it all seems convoluted, and we have to go, we have to turn to marching to start to get the story straight and to start to get a real investigation happen. It just seems ridiculous to me. And it's not just Trayvon. It's a mm-hmm. lot of people right now. I mean, there's several cases right now, both black and whites alike, who have either been, you know, shot because somebody, you know, thought they were somebody else, they thought they were trespassing, or, you know, the police have gunned down somebody that they weren't really quite sure about. We have this happen over and over and over again, and it seems to me that there's a point in which we have to start to think about how do we tell people to train them how to see someone else and then decide whether it's suspicious or not. And mm-hmm. I say that because we seem to have this culture of fear since 9/11 mm-hmm. and how we've had the TSA do all these things. I'm like, I've been to countries like Israel where they do profile, but it's very different. And you right. don't have all these people feeling you up and taking your shoes off and everything else. I mean, it's from the airport on down, we're all afraid. And as a result, we get nothing done and things still happen. And that's what gets me, is that people don't seem to understand that stuff happens. And it does, you know, you can feel as though you're protected as much as you possibly can be, but it does not stop events. And nor does it stop an event when you try to take it into your own hands.
Mm-hmm. Although I want to just, as a counter anecdote, I mean, I mentioned earlier, you know, about a year ago, I jumped just a few blocks yeah. from my apartment, and you know, there was a guy across the street from mm-hmm. an Elks Club, and there was a guy there working late, and he ran out, and you know, he didn't wait and call anyone. He ran out and sort of blew a whistle, and was obviously sort of ready to kind of run over and help. Yeah. And you know, if he had waited and said, "No, I'll leave this to the police," I would probably have taken a lot,
worse,
been a lot worse for the wear than I was. And also, just actually a few months ago, again, just right in the area, there was a case I know where, you know, it was a couple of robbers used a young girl, sort of feigning the need for help. She was sort of came and knocked on the door late at night, saying she'd been assaulted. And apparently, they had tried this at a couple doors, was the person who responded, who then ended up getting, you know, basically beaten and tied up until
home invasion.
I think that, you know, the kind of, you know, aside from obviously the destructive, you know, horrible trauma that that person suffered, the, you know, what that does sort of to the to the community, to make people, you know, unwilling to you know, the idea that if you, you know, you go knocking on a door because something has happened to you at night, people are not going to help you.
Yeah, exactly. I probably would have looked at somebody knocking on my door and said, I'll call somebody for you, but you need to stay outside. Yeah. You know, but in your case, when the guy blew up the whistle off for the Elks Club, I mean, that to me is like that. Now, that's citizenship, right? That's the moment where you do see somebody in trouble and you actually act. I mean, in that case, yes. The Zimmerman case is like a case of, I'm going to go find out what's going on here, you know, and nothing's happening. Yeah. It's just somebody walking, right? So that's where I feel like the difference is. I mean, you were clearly in a case of, I'm in trouble, right? Somebody's jacking you. You got to get, you know, good for the guy who blew the whistle and was, you know, was hoping to come and help you. But, you know, in these other cases, like you say, people prey on the good, you know, the good vibes of others, you know, and do things that they shouldn't. And I think one of the things about this case that I hope comes out of it, I don't know if it will or not, is that we start to really rethink how we go about sort of the profiling aspects of things. I mean, I think that it's going to be very difficult to stop people from profiling, even if it's right or wrong. I think it's very difficult for people to stop it. It's the ingrained stereotypes that just won't go away, and I don't know how we do that. I think that's another generation or two in this country. I really do. But the second piece is that I hope that there's some serious conversation about the stand your ground law, because I just think it's sort of a license to kill and they're not 007.
Well, I don't know. You know, that's not clear. I mean, one of the things we've heard is that the invocation, numbers of justified homicides have spiked since this law passed. But it just seems like that means that are more people invoking that defense, which I thought it was intended to do. It's not clear that law is actually promoting more vigilantism, and maybe it is, but I haven't seen, I'm not sure what it would, I mean, why it would have that effect.
I only think it has that effect if you know that there's something that you can appeal to, okay? And I think for the average person who is a gun owner, you don't have a gun because of the stand your ground law, okay? You have a gun because you want protection. I mean, that's just the number one thing. And so what the law does, I think, is provide a space in which you can do something. You can have an argument about shooting that gun. Excuse me. But I don't think, you know, I don't think it's that necessarily. I think we just need to think about gun laws, period. I'll give you an example. Here in Pennsylvania, it is not that difficult to get licensed for a gun, but the Philadelphia Inquirer did a whole thing about how it was much easier for somebody who lived in Philadelphia to register for a gun in Florida, get that license, and be licensed to carry a gun here because we accept their gun licensing.
Right.
That's crazy. That it's easier for me to mail out something, never appear in person in Florida, and get a license and be able to carry a gun in Pennsylvania. That's crazy.
I mean, I don't know how much it's illegal. Look, I mean, you know, I live in D.C. where it is very hard to legally get and own and carry a handgun. Has not conspicuously reduced the number of guns being used in the city. If you look at, again, you know, Canada is not massively more restrictive than we are, doesn't have our level of gun. I mean, I don't know how much the legal structure as opposed to other factors is what gives rise to the problem, or that we're have that much sense that sort of the places with more restrictive gun laws are conspicuously kind of better off on that score than other places. So we just had a Supreme Court case involving DC's laws on that score. That said, it's not that if it were easier, I think I would want to own a gun. Although I might prefer that, you know, potential home invaders not be sure who does or doesn't have one. There's I think probably some value to that, but ideally is to make it not as necessary. One of the other things that interests me just as in connection to this is that a lot of people made a lot of the fact that when it turned out that Zimmerman was not to pure Anglo, but was a white Hispanic. I was really puzzled that there were like people mm-hmm. commenting on my blog who thought this was odd. I sort of said, mm-hmm. well, I mean, if you looked at the photo at the top of the blog, it is not that confusing a category.
Yes, exactly.
But it was sort of odd because it was odd seeing that people thought that was relevant. I thought this was a story about profiling and about the police mm-hmm. being willing to assume something about, a black teenage male. And people were very quick to kind of trumpet this, or at least, you saw a lot of conservative websites sort of trumpeting this fact. Weirdly, the Free Beacon, which is Matt Continetti's news site, went on this really bizarro tear about, mm-hmm. George Zimmerman, Hispanic Democrat, which is a really, as...
that was supposed to be...
Yeah, I wasn't sure what that had to do with anything. But I think it was... I realize the reason this sort of turns partisan is that what people are saying, okay, you can't kind of use this as a cudgel to accuse, we white America of racism. This isn't the case of white racism, at least. Either that, or people weirdly think Hispanics can't be racist, which I would.
That's what I think that the assumption was. If you ask me, is that they thought they can be racist, and I'm like, you have never lived in L.A. Please, I mean, everybody can be racist, okay? Everybody. So this is racism does not have some kind of thing where only lights on certain.
I mean, I want to say we're just so enlightened as a as a group that. We're just completely free of any specter of bias.
Right now you're free of this. You're free of this. You've gone through this already, right? I thought that was really interesting too. And what was also fascinating to me was to see how African Americans responded to that mm-hmm. in various places in the country. In the Northeast, it didn't get so much play. I think it got different kind of play in places like Texas and the West, only because there've been these where people are bumping mm-hmm. up against each other, And then it played out very differently. I mean, I wouldn't have cared if George Zimmerman was purple. The whole thing was just wrong to me from the beginning. So I would have had something. I would have had somebody say it's not wrong for him to carry the gun. If he was licensed to carry, he could carry it. But what I think was wrong was his, his sort of confrontation with this young man, where Neighborhood Watch is supposed to be about you're watching, and if you see something, you call the police. Clearly, he had done this 44 plus times before. Why couldn't he do it that night? And that's where I think his emotions stepped over their bounds. And that's why we're at where we are today. And I'm like, we haven't heard from him. We've heard from his parents. We've heard from everybody, with all their stories. I want to hear from him. I don't want to prosecute this anymore until mm-hmm. we hear what he has to say. I mean, Trayvon can't speak for himself, but I would certainly like to hear what George Zimmerman has to say. And I don't want somebody, this guy that came up for him, coming up to say, I'm George Zimmerman's friend, and yes, because I'm black, this means that George Zimmerman is not racist. That does not mean that. And that's what I think is the worst part about this whole thing. It's like having to listen to, the parade of friends on George Zimmerman's side and not to be able to hear from George Zimmerman.
Well, himself. I mean, if he's got a halfway competent lawyer,
it doesn't
seem
like
he's very
competent.
That, they'll tell you don't. I mean, I'm not surprised that, his lawyer is telling him don't. This is not the time to go.
Yeah, I'm not either.
But, of course, right. I mean, you want a grand jury to hear from him.
But the lawyer's not managing much. Yeah. He's not managing very much at all. I mean, that's just the problem is that, this constant parade of people coming out. I'm like, this is worse than it, you telling your client to speak. It's just bad. But anyway, thinking about what we probably should do to sort of move forward a little bit, we had talked about linking this to another piece of popular culture and racism, the Hunger Games. And I'm going to let you tell that little story first because I just saw the movie yesterday and I'm still sort of mulling this over. But I have to say, I was pretty stunned when I saw the piece about racism in the Hunger Games and I went, what are they talking about? Are they kidding me? Isn't this just supposed to be some teen novel about kids fighting?
The Gawker actually ran a story about this and a lot of people were talking about it last week. But there was a sort of bizarre sort of social media flurry of comments of people who had come out of that movie, and there are two characters in the books who are clearly written as black in the books, although it's not made a big deal of. It sort of mm-hmm. says at one point they have dark brown skin, and otherwise not important, but Rue and Thresh. And Rue ends up being a pretty significant character as a sort of young, innocent girl. And there's a lot of people who, I guess, had missed those lines when they read the book and kind of reacted with shock that these two characters had been cast black. And in some cases seemed kind of actively disturbed by this, as though somehow their mental image of what was going on in the book had been disrupted, that somehow they didn't identify with or care about, I won't spoil it, but what happens to the young girl. And that was bizarre for a couple of reasons. I mean, the obvious reason being they're black in the book. Another reason being that, I think white non-Hispanics are supposed to be like less than 50% of the U.S. population by 2050. So even if race had never been mentioned in the book, I don't know why you would assume that in a book set 200 years in the future, a kind of randomly chosen character of unspecified race is white by default. You would think, if anything, the opposite would be the kind of statistical probability. And so you almost think, well, then shouldn't actually the cast of Hunger Games have been more, more non-white, basically? And I mean, I assume this is just that there's, focus groups and studies sort of repeatedly confirm this, basically, essentially non-whites will go see a movie with an almost entirely white cast, but that a movie with a, more than very small kind of proportion of non-white characters, it gets sort of, I guess, branded as a black movie, and so white audiences actually don't show up for it.
Exactly. I sort of wanted to think, is like these teenagers who were writing on the Twitter accounts and everything that the Gawker article was talking about, I thought, wow, this shows you how this issue of race can permeate everything, is that they couldn't see past the description. So they just automatically, in their brains, if you're white, you just associate that with another white person, right? I thought that was fascinating. And, I wish they would know the demographics that you talked about, but they don't. I mean, they still don't know them, and I'm a university professor, and I try to tell them, this is going to change. And everybody's like, really? It was fascinating to me, and then to see how the movie played it all out, I think was really interesting, because, in a sense, you would think that, I'm thinking about District 12, where the girl Katniss is from, who is the heroine of the Hunger Games, and I was looking out at the audience, and the audience that, the group of people, when they go to pick the kids for the reaping, they're predominantly white. And I got to started thinking about all these books that are out now about whiteness and what's happening to white people right now. And I thought, well, the Hunger Games is this moment in which this whole fear about what the future is going to be can really come alive, not just for the kids that have been reading the book, but their parents who are, taking them to see the movie and going, oh my God, this is probably what's going to happen, right? And then, the place that has all the money has all the you see a lot of diversity there, right? I thought that was really interesting, is that there's a lot of diversity in the city, but, out in these 12 districts, it's not so much diversity. And then you pit these kids against each other, and you've got a Rue who tries to help Katniss, so they have to build alliances, and then she ends up, being killed, in a rather brutal way with a knife in her chest. But, for kids to sort of to think that and to say, I don't really care that, I cared less about Rue dying now that I know that, she was really not white or something, sort of suggests to me that we somehow these images and things that children are seeing as they're growing up creates an image for them. And now whatever this generation thinks about race is going to be mediated somewhat like their parents, but also somewhat differently. On the one hand, they seem to be very much more accepting of mixed or interracial couples and kids. On the other hand, they seem to hold to some of the same racial stereotypes.
I mean, I will say, part of it is just that teen fiction like this is much more than, I mean, so like we also understand that in like adult literary fiction, might have a protagonist who you're sort of not supposed to, you're not supposed to identify with Humbert. Maybe at the best you kind of come to some kind of, you know, something that's not a complete repugnance, but no, for the most part, you know, that's sort of the reaction. You know, in adult literary fiction, the protagonist can be someone who you know you don't want to identify with, but teen fiction is primarily about identification. And so, I mean, that, you know, the Harry Potter and Katniss or whatever are much more kind of a surrogate for the reader. And so I think that creates a much stronger tendency to project and sort of assume when it's not described, or even if it is described, you know, okay, you know, I'll assume Katniss looks like me. I'll assume this young girl who reminds her of her sister looks like my sister or looks like, you know, someone who could be my sibling. And so that maybe part of it is that you know, in a book about identification, people project their own community into it, and so it may be that demographically or statistically, you know, that's weird, and your group is not representative. But it's a type of fiction where there's a much stronger tendency to kind of make that world, you know, about yourself in some way. One of the things I thought that, was really is just more generally interesting about Hunger Games is that, and we sort of talked about this a little bit earlier, is that it seems like this kind of perfect Rorschach, in that you know, there's a kind of obvious kind of class or race divide reading of it. There's but there's also, I think, a pretty clear kind of almost sort of Sarah Palin-esque reading of it, where the capital is where these frivolous political and media elites who are, you know, are living, and the real Americans or real Panamanians live out in the outlying district, and their lives are seen as kind of commodities.
And they kill their own food.
And so that's, you know, and there's the kind of just the sort of straight up media critique read of it. In a lot of ways, it seems like a book that's very kind of cleverly about projecting your own, you're finding whatever it is, you know, you want in it, which is, I think, what makes for you know, especially successful teen literature. Although we say teen literature, I mean, I feel like I in fact read these books. Also, it's you know, partly just because you can blow through all three of them in a Sunday afternoon. So maybe it's also why we've seen this kind of explosion of adults read. I mean, I hope it's not just that, you know, we've become too kind of lazy and short attention span to read serious books anymore. But,
yeah, read something like something War and Peace, right?
Yeah. But they're, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is just much more interesting. I mean, in a certain sort of way, because you can see it, right? I love what you talked about Sarah Palin, because I was thinking this yesterday. Like, oh, Katniss is just perfect. You know, she's like the Huntress Diana. She does all this stuff, but it really is sort of this Palin-esque kind of thing, and the ways in which you can map onto her whatever you want to. So when she's, you know, in the city, she's beautiful. She's all this other stuff. When she's out hunting, she's rough, and everybody likes her in the city. They like her in the country. But it's also pretty clear that she can start a riot. And that's what I thought was really interesting, when she decides not to go along with what they're going to do. And it becomes this whole, you know, uprising in a sense. And I think there are people like this now in sort of political ways who can do that sort of thing. And Sarah Palin definitely is one of them. It's like, no matter what side you're on about her, or whether you like her or not, she's a rabble rouser, and she can get things going. But I also think too, this whole idea of what the media does and how the media constructs things. I was really fascinated about how the controls worked, so they could bring out the dogs, and they could put whatever they wanted to in this forest to control what happens. And to me, you know, the allegory at the end of it was that how much of these strings get pulled in everyday life. So when we're in a political campaign or all these other things, how much is the media really controlling what happens? And I thought that was a really interesting thing, because you need them to get a message out. And if you don't have them to get that message out, then, you know, that it's too bad for you. And if you can't get, as the conceit was in the movie, you have to get people to like you, to sponsor you. And if you don't get people to like you to sponsor you, then, right. you know, you're doomed. You can't get, you know, little things flown into you when you need them. So it really was a very interesting sort of allegory to think about the ways in which our culture right now, you know, is playing out media, whether that's either, you know, in the prosecution or the persecution of the Trayvon Martin case, the, you know, our current political campaign, you know, popular culture, all this stuff, at the core of it ends up being media and how media operates. And if you can get a good story or a bad story, how your story gets written mm-hmm. is really the key.
I mean, and to circle this back, you know, I mean, I think this is the reason these things become weirdly contentious. You know, I mean, again, there's like, again, this the bizarreness mm-hmm. of like a partisan fight over a sort of tragic case. Is that, you know, there's sort of a limited media bandwidth. I mean, I remember reading that the Trayvon Martin case is basically the first news story of 2012 to eclipse the presidential election in terms of the to time and segments devoted to it by various news channels. Although interesting, there was also kind of asymmetry there. I mean, it was like CNN and mm-hmm. MSNBC were giving it a lot more attention than Fox until fairly recently. But it's that there's sort of a limit, right? I mean, there's just limited bandwidth, right? There's just a lot more stories to tell than there is space to tell them. And I think that's, you know, one of the reactions you had was, well, there was some horrific, I mean, you saw on conservative sites, there was this horrific case in, I think, Chicago of basically a white kid being lit on fire, you know, and then that was basically pretty clearly a hate crime. And say, well, why aren't why don't those get attention? Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
why aren't people talking about that? Because that's awful too. It's awful.
This is a case where there was an institutional aspect that is not just this awful, you know, this hate crime happened, but or you know, whatever it was mm-hmm. happened, but that there's a sign that the police sort of did less than you might expect. You know, because of their willingness to buy into it, you know, a certain sort of stereotypic complicit compliant version of events, but it raises the stakes of these because there's only so many stories you can tell, and just by necessity those stories become
exactly.
You know, I mean, there's what we call the available. You know, psychologists call this the availability heuristic, right? If you can think of a couple examples offhand of something like. You know, police looking mm-hmm. looking the other way, or not really doing a serious investigation because they assume that the black teenager probably was the aggressor. Then you are kind of prepared to assume that that is something that actually happens pretty commonly. And if you can't think of any examples, then you assume it doesn't happen very commonly. And so the stakes, mm-hmm. you know, kind of associated with what does get covered because it shapes people's perception of, you know, is this really a problem? Is this a thing that happens all the time, or is this, you know, every now and again still, but mostly we've kind of gotten past that, is so much a function of which kinds of stories of the way too many that any that you could tell telling, you know, break that threshold and become national.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it's also, you know, the ways in which stories are told that if they have a they have resonance to other stories. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? So in the case of the kid in Chicago, you know, that's awful too. Don't get me wrong. I read about that. That is horrific. But this Trayvon Martin story has resonance to a historical story.
Right.
So that you begin to sort of say, oh, this is just another piece of that narrative, and the narrative becomes recognizable to people. And I think that's also part of, you know, what happens in this country is that how can the media tell a story effectively? If they can tell a story effectively through a lens of a story that they already know, mm-hmm. then it's told a lot easier and a lot faster than some other stories are. And I think that's also very problematic.
Yeah. I mean, this is actually one of the few points on which I find myself in agreement with Noam Chomsky. We don't, you know, there's not a huge Chomsky section in the mm-hmm. Cato Library, but But one point he makes that I think is absolutely right is that the kind of formal constraints of television in particular mean mm-hmm. that you can basically only tell familiar stories. You know, if there's a narrative you want to tell that breaks with a kind of convention that you can recognize and readily understand, if you're kind of questioning the premise of a conventional story about how the world works, you just can't do it in 5 minutes. And so, in a way, the only thing you can do if you've got a five-minute segment is something that, with a couple visual cues, with some familiar stock footage, you can set up and convey. And the more, I mean, in a way, the more media bifurcate, I think, the more you have this weird thing where there are two grammars and sets of convention now, right? I mean, there is a set type of, you know, conservative media story that is super familiar now to consumers of conservative news and commentary outlets, where, you know, you have, you know, the 2 minute thing, and you kind of recognize the script that fits. And so different stories actually become even intelligible to us in a strange and probably unhealthy way. And so that may explain kind of why, you know, part of the divide here is that there's different formats. I mean, so for example, I mean, speaking of historical resonance, I mean, part of the problem is, what are you comparing this to? If you look at conservative news sites, the immediate historical, you know, reference point here is like not Emmett Till, but Tawana Brawley.
That's a good one.
So exactly. Which, you know, so you, it's sort of a which scripts are you automatically kind of reading from? What's the genre? Are we, you know, what kind of movie are we watching?
For conservatives, it would be Tawana Brawley. I'm hoping it's an Emmett Till script. I really, you know, I think in this particular case, it's not going to be a Tawana Brawley, just because there's so many things that are, you know, different about it. It reads more Emmett Till to me, but then I could say I was biased because I know too much of his history. But yeah, if it's a Tawana Brawley story, then it ends up being this whole other kind of thing. And you know, since you have some of the same parties involved too, then that makes it a lot harder.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is part of it. Also, there's a way in which, as soon as, you know, Al Sharpton is involved with something, you'll have folks who are, you know, again, assume a certain script fits,
and
that becomes radioactive. I don't, I don't know what, is there any way, I mean, so part of, again, what's depressing here is, like, realizing how kind of, when something like this happens, that how predictable it is, and in a way, how kind of elementary a point the conversation starts at. It's like, you know, it's like square one. It seems like this has never happened before, that we've never, you know, people talk about, like, oh, national conversations before, about, but it's always sort of the same conversation, it seems like. We don't get to the point where we've laid the groundwork and now we can
have a different conversation. But I think that's also about the responsibility of, and I dare say, I mean, the responsibility of the media is to itself to, you know, generate ratings and things like that. But I also think, you know, at least for me, and this is where I sort of end up at the end of all of this, is there's a civic narrative, okay? And the civic narrative to me is that you want justice done and that you need to be civil in the midst of it. And that to me is part of what's missing, is being civil in the midst of a disagreement. Because I think that all of our, you know, rhetoric is so, you know, inflamed now, that it's very difficult to have a civil conversation about something that is an injustice. Or that you feel is an injustice, because everybody has to take high moral ground, or at least be louder so they can take high moral ground. So you miss all the nuance in these arguments, and it's just too hard to make nuance in a kind of argument where you have something that's so heinous that's happened.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be the other way, right? It was supposed to be that the internet was going to allow us the sort of luxury of having, you know, having the kind of conversations and the kind of stories that you couldn't do in 5 minutes on cable news, and going to give rise to these sort of more nuanced discussions. And you know, obviously we're not quite there yet. Although, you know, maybe you have both things happening, and it just turns out that actually, you know, people just the constraints of people's times is they're not interested in the more, you know, cutting out conversation, because it doesn't serve.
It doesn't serve the 5 minute purpose of I want my soundbite and leave it, right?
Right.
Or it doesn't serve the Twitter feed of, you know, 140 characters, 144, whatever it is. But yeah, no, you're right. So, I guess on that note, we should probably figure out what the last thing we want to say, since we've had a good civil conversation about this whole thing.
Crazy.
What would you like to close out with?
I don't know. I feel like I've said most of what I had thought about this. I mean, I guess just that I mean, I'll just go back to this. The part of the promise, but also the risk of making these stories allegorically significant is that people get committed, you know, to these simpler versions of it. So one issue here is you know, a need to kind of assume the most extreme, you know, version. So either, you know, Trayvon was, you know, a thug and this was his fault, or, you know, Zimmerman was like a kind of irredeemably awful person who bears also complete responsibility. And it just seems like totally possible to me that there's some more ambiguous, you know, probably I'd still say, you know, I'd say he probably is, you know, 85% or 90% responsible. But there doesn't seem like there's room for ambiguity. And part of the reason, I think, is because part of what explains some of the white reaction that was sort of so relieved that Zimmerman was, you know, was a Hispanic was, I mean, it was kind of the white version of, you know, like hearing about a crime on the news, being like, oh, God, please don't let him be black kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it okay, you know, this because it's allegorical, you know, I don't want the, you know, there's a part of the audience that says, I don't want, you know, of the white audience, I think, that says, I don't want to be implicated in continuing white racism, because if white racism is still a problem, you know, in some way that charges me with being part of it. And so I don't want, you know, I don't want that burden basically on me, you know, yeah, rightly or wrongly. In a lot of ways, that's what the Hunger Games is about, right? It's about this particular you know, how she becomes an icon, how she becomes a symbol, and how kind of disconnected from reality, how reality showish it becomes, both, you know, in the initial stuff, but then also when she's become this kind of revolutionary symbol. And so I guess my slightly rambling conclusion is we should probably be like a little skeptical of neat allegories.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe, you know, I'll just say it simply is that you just should be skeptical of neat stories, and that I remain skeptical of everything. And also that I hope at the end of all of this, you know, that we, you know, if there is whatever truth there is to find out about the Trayvon case, Martin case, that I hope that truth is found out in the court of law.
Yeah.
And not in the court of public opinion, because the court of public opinion is always going to have opinion based on not all of the facts, and we need as much of the facts as we can possible. And so I hope that this case is resolved in a court that is fair and just, and not just in the court of public opinion. So
we're lucky that it got enough attention from public opinion that we might actually see that happen now.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for your time today, Juliet. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Cheers.
Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Okay.